Welcome to the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast, produced by the History Network. If you have any comments or ideas, email editor@ancient-warfare.com. And for other discussions, check out the Ancient Warfare Forum, which you can find a link to at www.ancient-warfare.com. You can also find all the History Network podcasts by going to www.thehistorynetwork.org.
Hi everyone, we're back with another Ancient Warfare discussion. This time we're going back to one of our very first issues, issue 1-3, which dealt with protection, helmets, shields, and armor. And with me tonight are the usual suspects, Murray Dom, this time in Iowa.
Hello.
Lindsay Powell, as always, in Texas.
Hello.
And Michael Taylor in California. We've got a whole American trio here.
Hello.
Note, located in America only. How should we start off today? Lindsay, maybe you can give us a boost. Why would people wear armor?
Why do you need protection? Very simply because you will die if you don't have protection. The issues that it raises are, it comes down to the opponent that you're fighting. So if you're dealing with slashing weapons which come down, you need shoulder protection. If you've got spears, you need protection for the main thorax, and so on. So it seems to be, it's very clear through the different theaters of war in the ancient world, and also the different armies and the peoples, that would go some way to explain why you get such wide variety in the different styles of armor particularly.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting that the current age right now is seeing a huge resurgence in military body armor. Say World War II, no one would have had body armor other than a, you know, tin helmet. And today you're seeing the kind of new ballistic armor. And I think it's, interestingly enough, raising a lot of the same issues that the ancient world faced, in that there's increasingly a trade-off between body armor and mobility. You know, the more armor you have, the clumsier you become, even if you become sort of more impenetrable, and that also can have risks associated with it. So certainly, you know, even in the ancient world, you see, you know, do we have very heavily armed soldiers who have to fight in relatively immobile formations? Maybe with the, you know, the Greek phalanx being kind of the epitome of this on the infantry side, or do we have very lightly armored soldiers who are extremely mobile and quick and agile, but as a result have next to no armor, and if they, you know, get hit, will die. And obviously this would be the Greek peltas, Roman velites, and, you know, light infantry throughout ancient history. And in a sense, is the fact that both these soldiers exist side by side just show that these are two trade-offs, and in a way, if you're an army, you kind of need both.
Well, that points to a very important point. You've actually got the body armor, but it's actually the body armor en masse with these additional things. So there's kind of two levels of armor, isn't it? There's the individual, and then there's the group. The way that you compact all these people together, in fact, can make it a very solid and very defensive position from the point of view of the soldier.
Yeah, you also got the divine protection all the way through from Homeric, you know, God-fashioned armor, Hephaestus making the armor for Achilles and Ajax, and then through to, you know, the barbarian races and beyond, who eschew all visible forms of protection because they are under their God's protection, and therefore they can be naked. And that sort of defense in faith, I suppose, which, you know, they seem to have believed in.
So. One of the other, I guess, downsides of armor is that it's actually difficult to procure. It's expensive to either equip your own forces, or, you know, if you're requiring your soldiers to provide their own armor, which is common in the ancient world, it means you're limiting the number of people that you can recruit. You know, I think probably one of the reasons, say, that the Romans are able to get so many people into the legions is that the mid-Republican Roman soldier, by some standards, is very lightly armored. At, you know, in many cases, he may just have a helmet and a very light little chest protector. And yet that means you can have more people if they're sort of have light to medium armor, rather than a smaller number of heavily armed soldiers, simply because it's just so expensive to actually produce and manufacture that armor in an era before mass production.
And in the Macedonian phalanx, you've got the idea that the front ranks had greaves and everything. And then as they went back further, the middle phalangites basically had very little protection other than their shield and their helmet, because they wouldn't, you know, come close enough to be in danger.
Interesting, Murray, because in a sense then, what that tells you then is that they have a very monolithic approach to their style of fighting. In other words, there's the front rank, which is effectively immobile. It's the front wall, and everything else is really pushing and shoving and maintaining a coherence, as it were, as opposed to what we're told of the Roman army, certainly in its middle stage of development, where presumably what you're seeing is rotation of the front line. So everybody has to be equipped in the same degree. And there has to be mobility. Mm. That's a completely different mode of fighting.
I mean, I guess the interesting thing, I think, though, again, with the Roman sort of mid-republican system is you would have seen even amongst the what we might call heavy infantry, not counting the Velites, who would have been totally unarmored, is that even then there would have been great variation. You would have had, you know, wealthy men wearing full suits of chainmail, and they might be fighting side by side, a very poor man who, again, is lucky to have like a little, you know, dinner plate sized piece of copper, you know, protecting his heart, but not much else. And some of that was just a consequence of the fact you do have a militia system. You are requiring your soldiers to provide their own armor, and there's going to be great variation in the quality and quantity they can provide.
And I think it's all the fault of the 19th century, really, that uniform is uniform, whereas the variation across vast expanses of time would have meant that you would have had a very polyglot uniform, because they're not going to throw away decent metal. But there'll also be trends, and you know the latest fashion and helmet, and the latest fashion and shield and armor, will take time to filter through. You're not going to throw away a decent helmet, especially the superstitious nature of soldiers. That if your helmet has protected you from three head blows, you're not going to throw it away. You're gonna keep that dented thing on your head because it's brought you luck. Whereas you should go, well, actually, the stresses on the metal now make it, you know, brittle, and you should change it. That's just, you know, that's not going to appeal. So you are going to get that very ununiform look, and wealth and all of those factors. And of course, stripping the dead. That you are going to strip pieces of armor from your fallen enemies and display and wear them. Especially if they're superior to what you had previously, then it's a sort of a double whammy. But getting back to the phalanx, because the phalanx, the Macedonian phalanx, there's the mid file leaders and then the rear file leaders and the front file leaders, and they were the ones who were more protected. So within the Macedonian system, they could have flexibility, so they could expand their ranks didn't need to be 16 deep. They could go to 8 deep. They could go to 4 deep, and those front rankers would still be protected to the relatively to the same degree, so that they actually had that sort of accordion like a flexibility. Whereas if you were man number 4, you wouldn't have much on at all. It's an interesting thing, because with the Roman system, that sort of what we perceive to be a uniform protection system in the different types of legionaries sort of makes it much more interchangeable. Which is one of the, I think in comparison to the Macedonian system, it's more flexible, which is why it is able to defeat the Macedonian phalanx in the 2nd century BC.
Yeah, I think that's a very important observation. And it continues that dynamic of change through its next 400 or 500 years also. There seems to be a willingness in a sense in the, and I don't know who it would be. I guess it would be an individual general perhaps at one point, or maybe there would be some commissariat that sort of makes some of these decisions on the fly. But they continuously seem to be adopting armor that's been seen in service from other opponents, which they say, that's really good. Why don't we have that? And they'll put that in the armory, and they keep evolving this. And it's very interesting thumbing through the magazine through each issue. I mean, the latest one, which has, for example, the Sassanids and so forth, it's just the extraordinary difference between that and, let's say, 300 or 400 years ago. I mean, they're completely different.
The thing I was thinking is that, of course, the Roman individual equipment would have been very different, but the Roman shield, of course, is, as we assume, more or less the same for everybody, and that takes an enormously important place in the tactics of the Roman army. It is the primary defense, not whatever you wear on your body.
And I think also that, more importantly, there's much more, much more uniformity with shields than there is with anything. I mean, we know of the Romans using, you know, multiple styles of helmets, different types of body armor based on wealth. But if you are in the three, you know, the triplex Achilles, it seems that just about everyone is going to have the same type of shield, the scutum that's oblong, maybe some slight variations in the size or the measurements, simply because presumably these were all made individually and there was no mass production. But it seems that that's where you actually start getting your uniformities and shields rather than individual body armor.
I think that's what it is. I mean, the Roman scutum, of course, is, well, it's not unique in the ancient world, certainly, but it's the first perhaps major nation that uses a shield that protects almost the entire body, that allows the soldier to maneuver individually instead of as a Roman soldier does not seem to depend as much on the support of his comrades because he has this shield that protects him.
Yeah, I mean, and the other interesting thing is, I mean, I know there's you know, people like Hans von Wies or, you know, argue that the phalanx should be seen as a more open, flexible formation. I am kind of a traditionalist that I assume the whole point of having this huge round shield that extends in two directions away from you is so you can interlock with other people's shields. That's just geometrically what that it makes sense to do with that shield. And likewise, I think it makes much more sense geometrically for the Romans with the shield that protects more of you, that doesn't have any edges to interlock with anybody else. I think that shield actually suggests a much more open, fluid, loose formation, which probably does emphasize one-on-one combat much more than, say, a round shield where you're actually encouraged to interlock and cluster up with soldiers next to you. So I think shields probably do have a major role in the kind of tactics, even if those tactics almost can sometimes be kind of unconscious, just what, you know, what soldiers want to do in terms of linking together or not.
And to take a theme a second, what I find intriguing is the fact that we seem in the early part of the Roman period really adopting Celtic style, Greek style hoplon shields. So we have oval and we have round. And then as we move towards the Republic, we tend to we sort of square those up. We still have some curvature to them, both across the front of the body, but also actually from top to bottom, as it were. And then it sort of becomes this rectangular shape with the umbo, the shield boss in the center. And I think that kind of lasts about 200 years, and then it goes back to more of a round shape again. So I think your point is well made that it then reflects in the way that the army is fighting. So during the Principate, the army is probably fighting very much more as the checkerboard en masse in these very large land battles. And then as it moves forward in time, then the opponent is becoming more cavalry-based and so forth. But what I find intriguing also is the way that you use the shield. So what you typically see in reenactment groups for the Roman period today is that they will form up in a dense line and they'll sort of lock their shields pretty close together and they'll put their gladius between. So the idea is you hold up the shield quite high so your eyes peer through. So you've got the protection of the helmet, your eyes are really the only thing exposed. And then your shield is like a cleaver or a machete, if you will, on the side. When you actually have the curved one, what you in fact have to do is you have to have more of an overarm movement in order to be able to engage the shield because you've actually got more space. So what you use is that little sort of wisp of space above you. And I wonder whether, in fact, as the Roman army developed, these changes were taking place. You end up from a sort of an overarm stab to a sort of mid-waist stab, as it were, and then it changes again as the opponents do.
You know, and obviously that's hard. You know, particularly in the Republic, the very few visual representations of close combat, all the swords of, I mean, I'm thinking of the altar of Aemilius Paulus, not the altar, the monument of Aemilius Paulus at Pydna. It is interesting that we do actually have on that monument evidence of people using shields as weapons themselves. There's a Roman soldier and a Macedonian cavalryman's coming at him, and he's using the shield to unseat the cavalryman. Presumably, he is then going to go and kill him with his gladius, which unfortunately that stone has fallen away. So certainly we do have some evidence that you can you actually are lifting up the bottom edge of your shield and hitting people with it. In part because you can actually have more reach with your long shield than you do with your short sword. I'm just thinking of like the metopes at Adam Clissey. They do seem to show soldiers stabbing kind of from the waist in some, but also just slashing overarm, both kind of having the shields out in a kind of protective position.
Well, there's also the one from Mainz, I think, as well, which has the intriguing situation where you've actually got one soldier who's kind of leaning into the shield and holding and looking to really push. But the one I think beside him, I think actually has his lifted up.
Yeah.
It's almost, it's an overhead protection almost. It's kind of intriguing. What? Why would the sculptor portray that? Is it a significant moment in combat, or is it just it looks artistic?
The whole idea of an artist depicting something that's actual or figurative or, you know, real combat situations, and there's the argument that the Adam Clancy artist is more accurate for, you know, as opposed to the Trajan's Column artist, for instance. So that's the argument, to say that he's depicting what he actually saw, as opposed to a Roman urban artist who might never have actually seen legionaries in action.
Yeah.
So you can argue, therefore, again, that the those depictions out on the fringes are far more likely to represent how fighting occurred, which again is much more flexible than the traditional hunker down behind your shields and lock with your comrades.
I know Tacitus also, in describing the fighting at the Mons Graupius, also says that Batavian auxiliaries are using their shields in this kind of 1-2 punch, that they're somehow striking a blow with their shield against the Britons, and then when the Britons are dazed, they're you know, dispatching them with a sword. So it does seem that this kind of shield as both a defensive weapon, but it's also a pretty good offensive weapon, because you're basically like a boxer. You're fighting with both hands, shield in one, sword in the other.
And indeed, and going back to the thing about the Macedonian phalanx, if I remember right, the way that you hold the hoplon shield is that you have a vertical brace, and you actually have your elbow in the corner, and your forearm runs across the width, I guess that would be the diameter, of the circle, as opposed to the Roman style, where you're actually holding it at a hand grip in the middle. So in other words, the one is evidently a defensive weapon, which you would use, and you'd presume then use your spear, your long spear on the top of that or below it, whereas the Roman is trained to use it just like you say. It's basically a boxing glove, a very large one, but that's what it does.
That's the Greek hoplite, not the Macedonian. The Macedonian shield is very small and just hangs from the guy's shoulders, basically.
These are also very expensive pieces of equipment to make. If you think about it, I mean, you're dealing with, again, I use the Roman example because I actually have, it's a Bishop Olson's book in front of me. It's a sort of a plywood made of different layers, I think up to three different layers laid at different angles and glued together and then shaped. And I don't know whether if I've got this right, that the hoplon shield was actually carved out of what, one piece of wood? But then on the other, it's got bronze edging potentially, and it's got decorations. So this is actually a piece of equipment that's had lavished care over it. It's expensive to make and very expensive to replace, of course.
But then again, making a Roman scutum is not easy either, because you have to have those layered pieces of wood and then make them curved. You have to make a mold and bend your shield into that. And keep it there for a while.
Using materials that you can use as steam or something to. There are particular kinds of woods which are ideal for that kind of thing.
In the case of the shield that was found in Egypt, the Kashr el Harit shield, which doesn't exist anymore, it's just disappeared. It consisted of three layers of parallel planks of alpine birch wood.
But it's very interesting, because they've if that thing has gone missing and they're trying to reconstruct it, it does make you wonder how accurate the reconstructions can be. All we've got is presumably some sketches. But it's formidable. I mean, it's 125 centimeters tall, I think this thing is.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from the days with the Urban Street Guard that the one that we rebuilt was hideously heavy. It was really heavy. So it's the trade-off. And I think Michael made this point earlier, that the program was... It's the decision that you make about mobility and protection, and there are always going to be trade-offs between those things. And I suspect the armorers of each of these different armies through history were constantly grappling with someone comes up with a great new idea how to make chainmail. Well, how does that compare with linen, for example, or some sort of sheet metal or some other kind of combinations? And intriguing is the prospect that from Carleon last year at the end of the 2010 season, there seems even to be this hybrid, which is, if I've got this right, sort of ringlets of metal or discs of metal, which appear to have been sewn or attached somehow to maybe a leather jerkin. It's very Hollywood, in fact, and wouldn't it be funny if Hollywood got it right all the time? But there's a possibility. We probably have many fewer examples of the very wide range of types of armor that were used in the ancient world.
No, that's certainly true. The interesting question that brings, really, is how does this development go? Does somebody come up with a new type of armor and people start to wear it, and that sort of gradually influences, your tactics, or is it the other way around? You find a certain style of fighting in your culture fits, and then people find protection that goes with it.
So I can advance this hypothesis, and it's not without any evidence, frankly. Is if you take the so-called lorica segmentata, which everybody knows is not the name the Romans used, but anyway, it's the articulated body armor that we all know and love. It does seem to start to appear around about the sort of 15-16 BC, and then becomes prevalent all the way through. And we actually have examples of that from Dangstetten, all the way from Kalkrise, and all over the Roman Empire at a certain point. And that does, then this is my hypothesis, it does tend to hint that someone sat down and thought, we're now going to be engaging a different kind of warrior in the Alps, and more importantly, as we get ready for Germany. And what we have right now is probably not going to work. So we need to scale up this style. So someone has the idea to develop it. Who? We have no idea. But it does seem, particularly in the north and central theater of war, become very rapidly very predominant. I can't speak to whether it was quickly adopted, for example, in the eastern theater. I suspect that because it's a heavy armor, and frankly, you sweat like heck in it in the sun, because I've actually done that in the south of France. I would argue that, for example, chainmail actually is better from a thermal management perspective, but I have no evidence for that. So it intrigues me that I think that the decisions could have actually been made quite high up in the command structure, simply because that somebody then got to authorize its deployment across the troops. And it's a major undertaking, taking a major investment of time and men and materials. And we've already discussed, if you start introducing one style of armor with one part of the army, you rapidly will affect the way that the rest of the army can actually fight. So there must be some considerable thought given to this right at the outset.
One of the things I would mention is that I've never been a reenactor myself, but I know from plenty of reenactor friends is that the chainmail is generally considerably heavier than lorica segmentata. And it's, of course, much more complicated to make because you need something like 40,000 rings of chainmail to make one vest. And this is, of course, possibly the reason why you see centurions still wearing the chainmail while the rank and file wears the segmentata, probably because the centurion could afford to have a nice fancy armor made, perhaps in bronze and iron ringlets, so it made a nice pattern.
I'll give you some quantitative data then, because this comes from the infantry guard. So we know it takes about 200 hours to make a what we could call a typical suit of lorica harmata, the chain. It weighs 11.8 kilograms, which is about 26 pounds, as opposed to, and you're quite right, Jasper, it's 13.2 kilograms or 29 pounds for the lorica segmentata. Now, the trade-off is you probably don't need to spend so many hours making it. So if you're scaling up for a theater of war and you need to equip your army very quickly, that's probably the way to go. You can actually build, my guess, you could probably build two or maybe even three, more possibly, of the new articulated armor for that armor to be deployed faster than the chainmail.
Putting the administrative hat on, it's going to come down to cost. If you can make two suits of armor in the same time it took you to make one, and then that's offset by the fact that you're using 4 kilos more iron, and that cost doesn't blow out the other cost saving, the decision's going to come down from above that you do the cheaper one.
I thought it was the other way around, that the chainmail was heavier than segmentata, but it might have something to do with the fact with how long your chainmail is and whether it's with or without doublet or Well, then of course if money is a big decision, then the big question is then why does the lorica segmentata disappear at the end of the second century, when, oddly enough, we know that money was a big problem.
Well, I wonder. I think it comes down to the pragmatics of war. I think the emphasis has shifted now from an attack force to one of defense. And again, I think when you look at the types of opponent that the Roman is fighting at that time in the different theaters, when we come to do the next podcast, we'll be talking about the Eastern frontier. You're talking about very sophisticated, well-armed people on that theater, not so maybe good on the northern frontier, but nevertheless, they're changing to axes and really some pretty devastatingly brutal tactics. And there's reasons why you would probably want to change from armor that was fashionable and practicable in the Principate to a much different style as you move into the later years.
You know, it occurs to me that, you know, the Lyrica Segmentata seems to maybe is kind of a unique case of the Romans inventing something themselves, when almost every other piece of major arms and armor that I can think of, either in Roman tradition or just can be archaeological linked to contacts with other people, and it's just a borrowing that we didn't come up with this better helmet, but we encountered a better helmet and we adopted it. We didn't come up with a better sword, but we encountered one and we adopted it. That on one hand is easier. It's you're not having to devote time to the R&D. In some cases, the adoption may be informal, just because maybe you've captured a large amount and soldiers just kind of start, you know, using what they pick up off the battlefield. But it actually is interesting that this actually seems to be a very unique situation where the Romans are actually coming up with a new design and implementing it themselves without, you know, getting it from the Spanish or the Celts or anyone else.
Well, I think that hints at that's kind of, if I use the word carefully here, the genius of the Roman commissariat, in a sense, is that they were able to scale up, I think, on a very large basis, and actually uniformly make stuff in a way that probably other civilizations up to that time hadn't been able to. And because they're typically on the offensive, I mean, they're the ones starting, for example, the German wars, and they're the ones starting the campaigns very often in the East. So they're able to prepare for them. I mean, they give these things, I think in the case of Drusus the Elder, it was like 2 years to build up the forces in order to attack Germany. Now, that was following in the wake of the Norican and the Raetian wars, where they actually presumably tested out some of this armor and found it was pretty good. It worked. In other words, as I've said already, as you move forward in time, Romans are no longer the offenders. They're not the offensive players now, so much as the defensive players.
And of course, there's an entire debate going on whether the Roman army, the tactics of the Roman army, did indeed change from the second century onwards into this. There's this whole sort of shield wall phalanx debate. I think it's argued by Michael Speidel, the Elder. The debate is between Michael Speidel and Everett Wheeler, I think. Because, of course, in the 4th century...
Yeah, Everett Wheeler's the legion has phalanx.
Yeah. I'm not looking at the page on ancientwarfare.com about Ancient Warfare 1-3, and I'm looking at a photo of a Dutch reenactor of the Fectio group, who is wearing, I think, a very heavy suit of armor. I think by now, actually, he's improved his equipment again, and he's now got greaves, which he doesn't have in this photo. He's got greaves, a shield, scale mail armor with a doublet all the way across the shoulders and chest, and a very heavy enclosed helmet, combined with a what I think would be classified probably as a pike again. Which suggests that this is completely different, of course, from the legionary we're all familiar with. So something must have changed substantially.
Well, I think it gets back to it has to be the opponent, doesn't it? I mean, it's somebody who's now fighting with a very long sword, perhaps, a double-handed slashing sword that you'd see in the Northern Theater, axes and this type of thing, whereas in earlier years it might not have been quite so lethal.
I am inclined to see the legion getting more phalangeal between Polybius and Caesar. There do seem to be some indicators in the equipment. The shields are getting, you know, shorter and squatter and squarer. The swords are getting shorter. The armor is getting heavier. I mean, this seems to be implying weapons that are moving in the direction of a more close order formation, where you don't have the same kind of room for personal initiative and personal combat. And I kind of suspect that a move away from the manipular organization towards something with cohorts, I think, does imply bigger tactical units and denser tactical units. Admittedly, this is somewhat of a hunch. I think the evidence is quite imperfect in these regards. Mm-hmm. We just don't have that many really detailed narratives of imperial era battles. But I get the sense that the legion is becoming more phalangeal. And then of course we have Arian, who turns his legion into a phalanx and is very proud of that. I do suspect that when swords become shorter and shields become squatter, I think that implies the formation is getting tighter.
And this hints that then some, should we put it this way, some grand intelligence behind the whole thing, doesn't it? So that someone at some senior level is deciding to make these changes, because they do seem to happen with a degree of uniformity across the whole empire. It's not that they're uniquely held only in, let's say, Northern Britain, but they never seem to happen in Germany. That they do seem to have more of a uniformity, which is to say, it hints at some logistics or the commissariat or there's some organization here that we probably don't have enough information about.
We don't know how fast these developments were. I know that we found Lorica segmentata in Israel, for instance, but Israel's a notorious case where anything that's not directly connected to biblical history gets shuffled underground. While, of course, we have generally very well explored sites in Germany and Britain and Holland, but not so much on the Balkans. We have no idea how long it took for such a new development to cross the empire. For all we know, this may have been, we talked about this in a very much earlier podcast. There's these centurions who go from one legion to the next, and perhaps it's just them that, they bring the message on. The legate told me to tell you that this works really well for us, and this is how you do it.
That's what the Praefectus Castrorum, because he's also going to be a long-term service person, but he's going to move.
Well, yeah.
I do agree that I think once you start creating a professional army, when you have legions that aren't, disbanding when the campaign is over, but are, have a continuity that starts to stretch for decades and even centuries, this may allow for increased forms of uniformity that hadn't existed before. You may actually have one legionary workshop in the legionary camp that is making the exact same type of sword for everybody. That this might explain why you see the sudden introduction of, say, the Maint style gladius. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do know that there are sword contractors out there. It is equally possible that maybe there are contractors who have big contracts who are enforcing uniformity. That they're delivering big batches of weapons to legions. But we also have plenty of evidence for very unique weapons into the Imperial Age, for different types of arms and armor existing side by side. I think I saw something on the Rat that suggested that a kind of Hispaniensis style gladius had been discovered from it was in Israel, but from the revolt from around 70 AD, which implies that this style may have even persisted longer than anyone thought it had, alongside these sort of new shorter Maints and Fulham style. So on one hand, I would say there probably is greater uniformity, and this probably has something to do with the fact that you have a professional army. But we also have to be careful. It there certainly was a lot of variation, and we know quite a lot of private ownership of weapons, which some guy, I guess, wanted a cool, different sword. He could go to the blacksmith and get it.
I think the other thing is, what is fast change? If it takes 10 years for a system and a new idea to permeate through the legions across the Roman Empire, is that fast or is that slow?
Well, it's so slow that you might at least say, well, there's not a central directive that says you have to.
But look at it from this point of view as well. Even in the modern armies, for example, NATO armies, for example, don't rush to market with the latest and greatest. I mean, these helmets that we've seen introduced and are ubiquitous across the American army now, and they're being used by a lot of the Allies and so forth. Interestingly, not by the British, that we still have the pudding bowl. It's the fact that they are in development over maybe a decade, and then they're tested to literally death. And there are huge amounts of test data that these have to amass before the DOD in the United States or the MOD in the UK. So in other words, even in our own day, it's amazing how slow these things are to be deployed across the fighting troops.
I mean, our difficulty is, of course, we have two finds that might be 45 years apart. If we can date them accurately, you can't argue decisively whether we've got the beginning of it and the end of it, or whether we've got, it's
the middle
just
in the middle.
The middle in the middle, and, it's actually a century-long change that we're seeing rather than the tail end and the beginning. So
that's one of the problems when you see in Peter Connolly, for example, that wonderful sort of family tree of all the different types of helmets. You wonder, this is a little bit like the evolution of man. Another find it'll completely create a branch of Homo sapiens if you're not careful.
Yeah. With the whole development and time thing, the arm guards seen in the Adam Clissey monument, they're like this radical new invention that there isn't any evidence for other than in gladiatorial combat prior to that. So you wonder if there's actually other sources of thinking. For instance, if you saw a retiarius with the defense on the arm, and then you know that you're going to come up against the Dacians with their downward slashing weapons, you know, who made that? I mean, who made that connection? Because, you know, the similarity in the arm protection is sort of an obvious one. And it's not something that we've seen in legionaries before. There's someone's thinking, how am I going to stop all my legionaries from having their arms amputated by
these? Just Powell's hypothesis again, for what it's worth. I mean, we're talking in the Roman times of actually a remarkably militarized society. I think in a way that modern people would find very scary, in fact, because the army is around everywhere. And your coins are constantly telling you about wars and defeats and victories. I mean, you never have to go very far away to be touched by the spoils of war in Roman society. And the gladiator games bring that war idea right into your own town. I mean, you're going to be visiting troops, or there's going to be a resident Lannister with his troop and so forth. And people are going to be fascinated. I'm sure that kids are playing gladiators in the streets, and they're constantly aware of all these different nuances and the different kinds of kit that they play. And that was part of the Roman, again, that was their thing. Their genius was to pit the lightly armed mobile one against the heavily armed slow guy, and let's see how they get on. So they're very much aware, just for their own entertainment, their sports fields, if you will, what works and what doesn't.
And certainly leaping centuries ahead to the 4th century, you get, Vegetius, who seems to have come up with, these are my ideas for what the army should be doing, and then they were received well in book one, and then he came out with books 2, 3, and 4, and other, you know, the anonymous Deribus Bellicus and others, which are suggesting, seemingly uninvited, what the Roman army should be wearing and fighting with. So you wonder if in earlier centuries there have been other pamphlets saying what should be worn or used or how, and so sort of meddling civilians, if you like, or meddling ex-military men telling the government of the day and the emperor of the day what's best for the Roman army. I mean, you can certainly envisage it in earlier centuries, and the problem is we don't have it surviving. I think that there's certainly a case to be made that that's happening all the time in the Roman Empire. We just don't have the literature surviving for us.
Well, I think you're actually right. So, for example, Pliny the Elder actually wrote a book which is about how to throw the javelin from horseback. So he's just one example. We don't actually have the book, but we know it's through Pliny the Younger that he wrote it.
Well, it is interesting that we don't hear of a lot of top-down innovation, or at least top-down innovation that corresponds to a lot of the changes. I mean, even I think one of the most controversial ones that we've discussed this to death is, you know, did Marius change the pilum? Well, we have sources that say he did, and yet we have a lot of archaeology that says he didn't. There's maybe some circumstantial evidence to suggest that Scipio Africanus introduces the Gladius Hispaniensis in Spain. Maybe, maybe not. But it's interesting that when the big changes happen, there isn't a lot of indication of, oh, you know, Caesar said change this, or the emperor said change this. And when we do hear of people engaging in this kind of top-down, this is what the equipment should be, it tends to be totally ridiculous. I want my legion to be armed like the phalanx of Alexander. It tends to be, and even like Vegetius, he tends to be arguing what the legion should look like, not based on any kind of practical military sense, but just because he's read, you know, Cato de Re Militaris and thinks, well, this is what they looked like in the mid Republic.
Yeah. And we're now getting our asses kicked, you know, worldwide. Why don't we return to the glory days of this is what the legion looks like? And so you've got that golden age antiquarianizing, you know, return to what worked, which is exactly what we were saying earlier, that if the Roman legion has altered its armament and its defense as it's encountered different enemies, then people saying, why don't we return to the legion of the first century AD, you know, the glory days of the Roman Empire, is a whole misunderstanding of the types of enemies that Rome now faces. Or, you know, Adrianople or whatever, the myth of Adrianople, is a return to a foe that they haven't fought for such a long period of time that then their current defensive armament and offensive armament aren't actually as good as fighting them off as they used to be. They've sort of lost that flexibility, if you like, or they've lost the edge that they had in terms of defense.
I think that's very insightful. Yeah, that's very good. point. There's another dimension to this, and I think we covered it in a previous podcast about how training of generals and the things that they wrote. We don't have, for example, the personal war correspondence of Aulus Plautius, for example, or some of these other, like Calcinus Severus, which I'm sure they wrote, because in part they were required to in order for the Senate to be sure that they were investing their money wisely, and it was a kind of end-of-term report. We only have Julius Caesar's, effectively, don't we? We have a sort of a moderately successful senator called Tacitus writing about his father-in-law. So those are the only two places we can look. And I would be not at all surprised that those people probably did discuss some of this minutiae, because it would be interesting to bureaucrats, you know, that they're boasting that they came up with this clever idea. And it was my idea, or actually it was his main ideas, but they take the credit. But unfortunately, it's all lost.
I think more frustrating than it all being lost and us having no idea is that we have sentences here and there which give us a glimpse, like Aelian, who's completely... you know, written off as a writer because he was a Greek philosopher writing about the Tactica in the age of Trajan. But he, in his preface, says, I went to visit Sextus Julius Frontinus in retirement at Formiae, and I talked to him about military science. And when he said that he didn't disrespect the Greek military science, I started thinking, oh, well, perhaps I could write one then. So you've got this sort of, you've got a philosopher going and talking to a retired general in his dotage, although, of course, he was going to come out of retirement. He didn't know that yet. And sort of they're talking about what's wrong with the army today. You know, why is military science not what it used to be? Which, you know, just old people don't change, I suppose. You know, these things are being discussed, and we have like four sentences across all of Roman history to tell us that it was being discussed. You know, there's another sentence where Cicero thanks one of his correspondents for sending him a booklet on how to be a general. That leads on to a discussion of, oh, I've read the Cyropaedia. Of course, I know what I'm doing. We read the Cyropaedia and we're like, what? I can't get anything useful out of that. You know, and so many stories of Scipio Africanus with the Iliad and Alexander the Great, you know, with their copies of these books that they regarded as handbooks to life and to soldiering that you read today and you're like, kinda? Vaguely, maybe, and yet they would, you know, they would swear by them, you know, that they, I think there's a fabulous, in the Cicero letter, there's the Latin word for thumbed away, as in he's read it so often it's deteriorating because he's basically worn it through, which is, you know, and you can sort of see them going back and again and again and again and again and again and again. What does Xenophon have to say about this? Well, nothing specifically, but it's there. And you're like, oh.
And it makes you wonder, doesn't it, so that I think, in conversation that they would probably, between them, I mean, the people in the fellow ranks at that level would say, well, what do you think then, service? Do you think that would be what he meant there? Well, and they'd be, you know, moving
sort of
fable or something. You know, it would be a constant discussion, I suspect, of meaning and interpretation.
And, of course, you've got the other idea that your way of proving your erudition was to refer to all these obscure works of literature, you know, and again, in the writings that are extant, we have lots of these works like the How to Throw a Javelin on Horseback that don't exist, but clearly they were written. Clearly there was an audience for them, and people who wanted to justify a certain path of action would refer to that work as a way of saying, see, I know what I'm talking about. So I think there is probably a huge conversation going on, and at various points of the empire, you can probably envisage that conversation is dangerous with retired generals, and Domitian, for instance, you know, Corbulo and Frontinus and these other generals who go out of favor and fashion. They're probably a worry because they're probably the men that people would go to and ask, you know, what would you do? And it's like, well, that's actually a treasonous question for you to ask me. You know, how would you solve our military problems?
And I can imagine that sort of discussion happening regularly amongst people who, because if you think about it, most of the Senate, in order to get to where they were, because their cursus honorum required them to do this, had seen service in the army. So they were really, I mean, unusual. Like no society that we have in Western Europe, for example, the United States, has the equivalent that when you send your men to war, you know, because you were there, you actually fought. You know the risks. And it's a heavy burden that you take when you actually vote in favor of it in that regard. But it also means that they have a wonderful curiosity about what things are being done on the battlefield and how can they improve the odds of winning and so on.
Well, and yet at the same time, I do think that it is interesting that the utter disconnect between the elites, the military writings that they produce, which, you know, even someone like Frontinus are interested they're not interested in equipment, they're interested in stratagems. Or Rigetius, who, if he is interested in equipment, it's what did the equipment look like 200 years ago? It's a disconnect between the elite, including people who are commanding the armies, and whoever is actually making the decision to, make the Pompeii-style gladius versus a mainz, or you know, wear a coolus helmet. I mean, I imagine that there must be some, if anything, mid to low level technocrats who are, actually deciding what kind of helmets are being made in a legionary fabrica, or it could even be a private contractor deciding, you know, what's the shortest sword he can make so that he can make the most swords with the most, you know, with the least amount of iron, and that's actually having much more impact on the weapons and equipment that the Roman armies using than these. You know, then again, with Cicero saying, "Well, you know, I've read a little bit of Xenophon, so I must be, you know, good to go." I almost ironically seems for an elite that does have at least a modicum of military service, the way they think about the military is still very abstract and has to be drenched in classical and literary precedent. Yep. In the modern times, I would say that our generals are much more technocratic. And, you know, you see debates throughout, you know, 20th century history of, you know, should the American rifle be a 30-06 or a .278, and very technical, dry questions. And you never see Roman elites dealing with these kind of dry technical questions with equipment, at least not that I can think of off the top of my head.
We just don't have the literary evidence. And I suspect it's because they were talking about that, you know, a goblet of wine in the evening, you know, sunsets. Hey, what do you think about the campaign? And blah, 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 blah. I was reading in the raw reports, it was never written down.
Isn't it also something to do with the fact that discussions such as books such as Frontinus's about stratagems can probably be linked in some way to philosophy and, you know, the kind of arts that a Roman gentleman, is supposed to practice.
Mm.
And, I mean, there is, and practical stuff, of course, they do also write about, you know, the best way to run your farm, which is a very practical thing to do. But you wonder if the Romans really did, at the higher levels anyway, cared about such things.
You get glimpses of it in, like, for instance, in the Castor Notation works, you know, very technical. This is how you lay out your camp. The problem, of course, no camp actually that exists corresponds to the way they say it's meant to be laid out, which is a problem. But
which suggests that it's actually a philosophical exercise.
But in terms of a very technical piece of literature and a Roman technocrat kind of way, they are there. You also get like anecdotes about hairstyle, for instance, that Alexander the Great told his men that they had to shave so that the enemies would have nothing to grab onto. And when they grab their faces, which sounds like a pithy, apothec mater kind of anecdote, but from a technical point of view, the dictum coming down from above that we will all be clean shaven and the Persians will not be able to grab your facial hair to wound you, you can interpret them as downwards as opposed to just pithy things. But the other thing that seems to be emphasized in Roman generals in their dotage and things, and even in the stratagems, is that it's about discipline and Romanness. That'll always see you through. That, you know, regardless of what you're wearing or what you're fighting with, if you're Roman and disciplined, you'll win.
Well, Virtus will always win out, won't it?
Exactly.
Show basic courage, that'll get you there.
Yeah.
Well, I think that makes a perfect circle, actually, back to, you know, what we said in the beginning, that some barbarians thought that they didn't need armor or physical armor in any way at all. It just, you know, believing in the right God and that would provide you and get you through the battle.
When the story of, you know, Scevus, the Roman centurion with 120 holes in his shield and, you know, his eye hanging out, so he rips it off and stomps on it, you know, that kind of just
that's for you.
Crazy discipline, you know, and steadfastness, and the stories, you know, of Sulla grabbing and saying, "Where are you guys off to? I'm going to the front line. You know, here's your standard. Go and get it." All of that stuff is far more inspiring nature of discipline and virtus than it is about what are you holding, what are you carrying. It's a sort of an undefinable quality that the Romans believed and, you know, had evidence for that they had in more abundance than other nations that they had suppressed.
But let me draw a parallel then, for example, and I think we have those in our own society and time. So, for example, very recently, President Obama actually honored a soldier who'd immense self-sacrifice, gone out and I think helped wounded soldiers and dragged them back in the way that heroes do. And in the UK, we had someone do something very, very similar. There are examples of that kind of courage, I think. And in the same way we honor the man and the deed, we don't worry about what he was wearing, because that doesn't make headline news, does it?
Yeah, the hero who went out to rescue wounded soldiers encased in metal and could not actually be reached or injured by the enemy bullets probably wouldn't quite make it, as opposed to the putting themselves in personal danger, which is always what's emphasized.
But that actually, yeah. The bottom line, that is actually what they're doing, you know. So I think that doesn't detract in any way from their heroism, of course.
Oh gosh, no.
Right, that was a very interesting discussion, everybody. But it's time to wrap it up again. I would like to thank you all, Lindsay, Murray, and Michael. Talk to you very soon.
You've been listening to the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast, produced by the History Network. If you have any comments or ideas, email editor@ancient-warfare.com. And for other discussions, check out the Ancient Warfare Forum, which you can find a link to at www.ancient-warfare.com. Don't forget, you can also find all the History Network podcasts by going to www.thehistorynetwork.org.